Hello and welcome to the CISS podcast. This is the Point series by China Forum. In this series, we will have one-on-one discussions with top-level officials, diplomats, well-known entrepreneurs, academics, and media experts from both China and abroad to hear their fresh insights on important global issues.
Hello and welcome to the CISS podcast, the Point series. This is Bei Bei with China Forum. In today's program, we will focus on discourse power in international politics. What is discourse power, especially in the context of political science and international order? Has China's discourse power been rising in today's world? And more importantly, what should China and the U.S. do in the face of widening distance and increasing friction between the two countries? Here with us today is Professor Rachel Hooley from Indiana University, who is also a postdoc fellow at the Harvard Belfer International Security and Columbia Harvard China and the World Programs. Professor Hooley will share with us her impression of conducting academic interviews in China and help us better understand discourse power in international politics.
Hello, Dr. Hooley. Very warm welcome to our podcast.
Thank you so much.
I would like to start our interview today with your trip to Beijing this past summer. And you were here at CISS, Tsinghua University, as a visiting scholar. And I know that it was your first trip back to China post-COVID.
That's right.
How was it? And what was the biggest takeaway from this trip for you?
Well, first of all, it was so good to be back. It had been a long time for me. I started my PhD with a trip to China and really getting to immerse myself in China's cybersecurity landscape, a lot of the laws, the rules, the regulations, the thinking, and the approach to global cyber governance. And then after the pandemic, there was a few years where we American scholars didn't really have many opportunities to be in touch with Chinese counterparts and vice versa. You know, we had always had kind of a steady stream of scholars coming to our universities that we could engage with. And we would usually plan to be in China over the summers. So I think there was a real longing to really try to have more regular engagement and a recognition that you really need to go to the country that you're studying and engage with it on a level of being there in person, having face-to-face dialogue. So for about 3 years, it was really hard to travel to China. So once I was able to go back this year for my fieldwork, it was really impressed upon me how valuable fieldwork is and how much I've been missing out. So for my dissertation and now for my book project, a lot of the work that I've been doing was quantitative. And so I've been collecting a lot of data, doing a lot of text analysis, as well as survey experiments. But the fieldwork that I did while I was in China was to engage with foreign policy elites. And I can wholeheartedly say that there's really no substitute for doing that. And I think if you are studying a particular topic and really wanting to enrich your knowledge of a particular aspect of Chinese foreign policy or Chinese domestic politics, it's really important to be in the country and to be engaging in this dialogue. So for me, I think the most important takeaway was really the value of these exchanges and dialogues. I just want to thank my hosts again at the Center for International Strategy and Security, CISS, at Tsinghua. They were incredible, helping me to meet experts in the field, helping me to kind of re-engage with some networks that had, you know, become rusty during those 3 years. And, you know, now we were just talking before the call about the next time that I'm coming to China, and there's this enthusiasm for maintaining the connections. And, you know, some of the contacts that I met, some of the new colleagues sharing their work with me, you know, sending it to me to continue engaging. And that's exactly what I think we all need to be doing now, is to really stay in touch with the scholarship, the ideas, the thinking in both the U.S. as well as in Chinese universities. And I think that just makes us all richer in our understanding.
I think we both sides feel that we're taking things less for granted nowadays. I mean, even traveling and also, meeting face to face seems so much more precious than, say, three or four years ago.
That's a great way to describe it. I think once you have that absence in your scholarship, you definitely feel the absence. And so it just makes all the interactions that much more special. And as you say, you don't take it for granted anymore that you're able to engage in this type of dialogue and learn from the other side and, you know, continue to do what academics do when relations are at a point of different levels, when relations are good, when relations are fraught. To be able to still have this academic exchange, I think, is immensely important.
And you have conducted many interviews in China regarding narrative power or discourse power. Has it been easy for you to conduct academic interviews in China nowadays? Are there any obstacles?
Well, I think for me, and possibly for the listeners that are engaging with this podcast from the United States or from other parts of the world, not within China, one thing that I would recommend is that I felt that my presence on an academic campus in China was actually rare. So when I was there in China before, it didn't really stand out that I was an American scholar. But when I was there for this most recent one, as you mentioned, over the summer, then it was a little bit more, as you say, precious opportunity that I felt. And I think that on the other side, for the Chinese scholars that were meeting with me, you know, there was less contact for engagement and interviews. So I can imagine that also led to some silver lining for my project, at least, that these academics were, and foreign policy experts and individuals at think tanks and many people in China were actually willing to engage. So that might be something that's also valuable for scholars to understand, that there's possibly less of us that are in the country. And for that reason, when you do go, there's a certain receptivity and there's a certain interest and a certain excitement when you are the one to send the email and you are the one to say, I have this project, in my case, researching what many scholars in China have translated Hua Yuquan to discourse power, right? And so I'm researching this, reaching out to people. And so there was a certain, I think, incitement about receiving my email. And you could tell in the responses to the WeChat messages or to the emails that I sent that people were really looking forward to engaging. You know, I didn't have many emails or WeChat messages that went unreturned. And, you know, a lot of people would say, like, well, would you expect the same thing in another major city, right? Because a lot of academics, a lot of officials are really busy. And it's true across the world that when you send out a request for an interview, you're going to have a low response rate. It's just the nature of doing academic research with elites. So I would say actually that's a really good response rate. People were really interested in engaging in dialogue and helping me learn more. I think also the other thing about discourse power that's just really special and unique is that it is a concept that is being proposed and developed by Chinese scholars and really elevated by Chinese officials. And so that's also something that added to, I think, the momentum is that you do have scholars that want to share more because there are workshops going on. There are academic conferences in China that are being held on this very topic. And so you have both at the top officials really communicating the value of China telling its own story and to engage and spread its voice on the world stage. But you also have academics really working at this very moment to kind of theorize and to understand what does this mean? How do we think about it in a political science perspective? And I would also tell listeners, it's not just political science, but there's communications departments that are working on this. There's Marxism departments that are working on this. So no matter what your interest is, this is a very rich topic. It touches on many different issue areas, many different fields of study within social science. And so I would say that my experience was really positive. It was very fruitful in terms of what I was able, the interviews that I was able to do for my book project. And I think audiences, when I present research now in the United States, sense the richness that I was able to obtain from people being so kind and generous with their time of meeting with me, of taking some people, you know, it's not just an hour. They would sit with me for an afternoon and really explain to me the richness of this concept. And so I just feel very grateful for the opportunity and also excited to share more about this in my book and in my research.
So it sounds like the scholars you interviewed were pretty open when answering your questions in this
regard.
Absolutely. Wonderful. I hope that's encouraging for other scholars who are maybe hesitating about coming to China and setting up interviews. And also you mentioned two things. One is China's story and the other discourse power. What is China's story in this whole context? What is China's message to the world?
Well, I think that China's story is something that we can't pin down to one particular thing. So that was really impressed upon me when I was conducting my interviews, is that discourse power is a very broad concept. So it's understood differently by different fields. And the field of international relations and political science does understand it as a particular type of power, the power that does come from the ideas and the narratives that you put forward on the world stage. So there's China's story that can come from students being exchange students in the United States, Europe, other parts of the world that others can learn about China. So there's an element of, I didn't know this before and now I'm learning something new about China. There's also China's story at more of the diplomatic elite level of seeing China and seeing China's proposals on the world stage and its vision for a particular type of collaboration. So that's what I'm most interested in, is really China's story and China's narrative about international order, how China sees the world, how China sees rules and institutions, what is China's main story, main vision and idea for shaping international order. And so I think following from that, we have the foundation of China's story, which is the concept of sovereignty. That's really at the heart of what China wants to advance on the world stage in terms of a unifying idea and concept. So reinforcing in different issue areas, sovereignty becomes important as a narrative in internet governance. So you have the longstanding message of internet freedom that really saw the world as this borderless vision of communication, and China's putting forth sovereignty, cyber sovereignty in particular. And so that was a distinction that focuses on the rights of all governments to set their own internal policies for the internet. And so shifting the focus in the area of internet governance would be one example, which is really at the heart of my research. But you can think about this as more broadly, kind of China's principles for international collaboration and connecting with other countries that wish to have more sovereignty in their international relations as well. So you think about countries that have had colonial history, kind of being reminded that sovereignty should be kept at the forefront of international relations. Or you think about developing countries, going back to cyber again, developing countries are really concerned about data colonization. The fact that a lot of American technology giants like Google and Facebook do control a large swath of the world's data. And so having a message of sovereignty is also appealing for officials in countries that want to gain more control and be able to have more national purchase over their data. So sovereignty is the foundation. And then you have kind of these global initiatives that were advanced. These are more of the pillars. So you have the Global Security Initiative, you have the Global Development Initiative, and you have the Global Civilization Initiative. And these are really setting forth more of the context behind what does a vision of sovereignty look like in different areas in development. For instance, really focusing on the right to development, focusing on equality is another big principle that comes out of this kind of foundation of sovereignty, right? All governments are kind of equal in their rights to sovereignty, and all governments should be sitting at the table to make the rules. And then kind of the roof, I would say, of this house is really the community of shared future being this unifying vision. So my research was really looking at each of these pieces, right? Really honing in on sovereignty as the foundation. And that's particularly true in cyber governance, which I study very closely, but also looking at other issue areas like human rights, climate change, outer space, and looking at how all of these messages are relevant and something that when you think about China at the United Nations, when you think about China and African relations, when you think about China's messaging, you really see these different layers at work, all laddering up to this concept or message of China's ideas about the world.
I see. Okay. And also the key term of our interview today is discourse power, which, as I understand it, is a translation of the Chinese term 话语权, with a literal meaning of the power or right to speak. How would you explain this term in the context of political science in your field of research?
Absolutely. I think this term is really important to understand through an international relations lens, but I also hope you invite others on the podcast that will explain it from many different lenses, right? From a media perspective, from a people-to-people exchange perspective, because it is such a rich term. But from my engagement with experts in China that have been working on this concept and really being at the forefront of developing this since 2012, 2013, really publishing articles on narratives as a source of power, I have heard from
a small group
within my interviews, you know, the translation is really about the right to speak, gaining voice on the world stage. But a larger majority really emphasized more of the second translation. So more of seeing this as a source of power. So discourse power rather than the right to speak. And that was really what most experts were recommending, that I conceptualize this as a source of power, a source of influence. And so I think that's really important for international relations ideas. It's important for great power competition. It's important for thinking about the competition for how rules and institutions are set in emerging issue areas. And it's important for China as it seeks to host conferences, as it seeks to put forward proposals like the Global Security Initiative, making sure that the message resonates with an audience. And so at a bilateral level, you see discourse power being used, kind of carefully study what are the values in common that each country shares, and really emphasizing some of the shared ties. At more of a multilateral level, you do have this careful construction of a narrative that is based on widely shared values. So we were just discussing sovereignty as being that value that's foundational to statehood. It's common to all countries. And so in my research, I'm also showing that when you are crafting international rules and when you're attempting to build new norms, you also need to have the support of other countries. So you may be a great power, but you do need to rely on these shared values in order to attract support. So that's really the key of discourse power, is you are attracting support. I think there's certain issue areas it becomes very compelling. So the field of international finance, investment, there's always been conditions attached to loans, such as in the IMF. For instance, you have a lot of conditions about needing to improve, possibly democratize, to really pay attention to human rights. There's also kind of a behavioral aspect. It doesn't just have to be the narrative, China providing investments or finance just on the conditions of need, not linking the conditionality. So there's both the expression of sovereignty at the United Nations of overtly incorporating this into speeches, but there's also different behavioral aspects that implicitly do mention sovereignty at the core of what China is saying. And I should just say, to trying to understand discourse power, I think it's also really interesting to unpack the ways that it's different from other concepts. So within international relations, we also think a lot about attraction. We think about support from the lens of soft power. This has generally been the way that we've conceptualized attraction. And it does differ somewhat from discourse power, in that soft power is typically using a country's culture. So when China conducts soft power missions, it's usually about Chinese language, Chinese history, Chinese culture. But what we've been talking about with discourse power is really using these common shared values. So they might be at the United Nations, they might be in both countries' history, but really trying to find some commonality between the official that you're speaking with and attempting to attract. And the other difference would be soft power is typically conceptualized as rather bottom-up. But under discourse power, we're thinking about ways in which great powers use ideas, use narratives in order to attract and appeal to others. And I would also say this is a very sociological approach to mobilizing support, and doing so through the basis of ideas. So making sure that ideas are at the forefront, not just material power, not just capability, but really ideas are what's granting power within this conceptualization.
The ideas are leading at the front.
Exactly.
So thank you for clarifying the difference between soft power and discourse power. I think that cleared up things a lot. And also, has China's discourse power been rising, in your opinion?
What I've seen is definitely at the United Nations, we've seen resolutions that China's proposed launch with majority approval. We've seen that in the area of artificial intelligence, there was a United Nations resolution as well. The US advanced one that passed. China also advanced one that passed. China's resolution focuses on capacity building and really ensuring this message of equality that's at the center of this shared future vision. And so what I would say is you do see discourse power on the rise in particular issue areas that I've been focusing on, particularly emerging frontiers, that China is both coming up with new proposals for how to structure international order. You do see China advancing new resolutions. And I think these resolutions do allow China to advance its voice on the world stage. Then I would say that we have seen China achieving success through discourse power.
I see. And last question for our interview today. So as an American scholar, you've always been in close contact with Chinese people. And also the fact that you speak perfect Chinese helps greatly in the building of your expertise in understanding China and also its people. But facing the widening distance and also increasing friction between the two countries nowadays, and in terms of politics and culture and narratives, what do you think we should do next, you know, from both sides?
Well, it's a great question. It's a big question. It's something that all of us are thinking about and wanting to contribute to. But I would say what I've been recently aware of, especially through my field work and opportunity to be in China, is that as a scholar that's now focused on discourse power and narratives, one particular side of narratives that's important to emphasize is the act of listening. And I think it's not just speaking, and it's not just about communicating your own message, but I think it's also about listening and engaging with the other side. And so in US and China relations, it does seem that when we can allow opportunities for the other side to truly listen to each other and truly engage, that really does break down stereotypes, that really does add nuance to understanding. And I think that at an official level, that would be something that I recommend for the policymakers, of course, but for academics, I think that it's important for us to be in dialogue, to be in exchange, to have these conversations. And I should say, on this episode, I am writing my book about China and its narratives and its use of discourse power. But, you know, the experts on this topic are in Beijing, and they've been writing on this and teaching me. There's
Zhang Zhizhou and Sun Jisheng.
And I think that both of these scholars are really at the forefront of thinking about these ideas and contextualizing them. So I'm listening to them. You know, I'm reading their publications that are coming out, and I'm trying to follow their thinking. And so I think that for all of us, we can listen more, we can engage more, and we can try to keep these channels for dialogue open. Because I think the alternative is really what leads to trouble, is when we stop listening and we become insular, and perhaps maybe domestic voices become stronger and domestic media becomes stronger. And so I think keeping channels open for exchange and open for dialogue, I think, is really at the heart of continuing to improve US-China relations.
Yeah, I think from our interview today, I have a deeper understanding of when you want to send out your message, it's good to start with listening to the messages of others first. So you build a foundation for building understanding and for better mutual understanding. And thank you so much, Dr. Huvi. I think it's been very enlightening, at least for me, because discourse power, you know, in our daily lives, we don't think as much about it. And usually it's rather vague for people to, you know, in the context of political science. But conversation with you today has been very helpful in understanding this term and also its manifestation in different fields. Thank you so much for your expertise.
Thank you so much
in discourse
for
power
the
in national politics.
Engaging conversation and for being such a great host. And thank you to everyone at Tsinghua. Again, I hope that I'll be back in China before long.
That was my conversation with Professor Rachel Huvi, who shared with us her professional expertise on discourse power in international order, especially how great powers like the US and China gain wider support with proper employment of discourse power. Thank you for listening, and please stay tuned for more.